This satisfying demonstration of our importance, buttressed by daily observations of the heavens, made the geocentrist conceit a transcultural truth. Taught in the schools, built into the language, part and parcel of great literature and sacred scripture, dissenters were discouraged, sometimes with torture and death. It is no wonder that for the vast bulk of human history, no one questioned it. It was doubtless the view of our foraging and hunting ancestors. The great astronomer of antiquity, Claudius Ptolemaeus, Ptolemy, in the 2nd century knew that the Earth was a sphere, knew that its size was a point compared to the distance of the stars, and taught that it, quote, lay right in the middle of the heavens, close quote. Aristotle, Plato, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, and almost all the great philosophers and scientists of all cultures over the 3,000 years ending in the 17th century bought into this delusion. Some busied themselves figuring out how the sun, the moon, the stars, and the planets could be cunningly attached to perfectly transparent crystalline spheres, the big spheres, of course, centered on the Earth, that would explain the complex motions of the celestial bodies so meticulously chronicled by generations of astronomers. And they succeeded. With later modifications, the geocentric hypothesis adequately accounted for the facts of planetary motion, as known in the 2nd century and in the 16th. From there, it was only a slight extrapolation to an even more grandiose claim that the perfection of the world would be incomplete without humans, as Plato asserted in the Timaeus. Man is all, the poet and cleric John Donne wrote in 1625. He is not a piece of the world, but the world itself, and next to the glory of God, the reason why there is a world, said John Donne. And yet, never mind how many kings, popes, philosophers, scientists, and poets insisted on the contrary, the Earth, through those millennia, stubbornly persisted in orbiting the sun. You might imagine an uncharitable extraterrestrial observer looking down on our species over all that time, with us excitedly chattering, the universe created for us, we're at the center, everything pays homage to us, and concluding that our pretensions are amusing, our aspirations pathetic, that this must be the planet of the idiots. But such a judgment is too harsh. We did the best we could. There was an unlucky coincidence between everyday appearances and our secret hopes. We tend not to be especially critical when presented with evidence that seems to confirm our prejudices. And there was little countervailing evidence. In muted counterpoint, a few dissenting voices counseling humility and perspective could be heard down through the centuries. At the dawn of science, the atomist philosophers of ancient Greece and Rome, those who first suggested that matter is made of atoms, Democritus, Epicurus, and their followers, and Lucretius, the first popularizer of science, they scandalously proposed many worlds and many alien life forms, all made of the same kinds of atoms as we. They offered for our consideration infinities in space and time. But in the prevailing canons of the West, secular and sacerdotal, pagan and Christian, atomist ideas were reviled. Instead, the heavens were not at all like our world. They were unalterable and perfect. The earth was mutable and corrupt. The Roman statesman and philosopher Cicero summarized the common view. In the heavens, he said, there is nothing of chance or hazard, no error, no frustration, but absolute order, accuracy, calculation, and regularity. Close quote. Philosophy and religion cautioned that the gods, or God, were far more powerful than we, jealous of their prerogatives, and quick to mete out justice for insufferable arrogance. At the same time, these disciplines had not a clue that their own teaching of how the universe is ordered was a conceit and a delusion. Philosophy and religion presented mere opinions, opinion that might be overturned by observation and experiment as certainty. This worried them not at all. That some of their deeply held beliefs might turn out to be mistakes was a possibility hardly considered. Doctrinal humility was to be practiced by others. Their own teachings were inerrant and infallible. In truth, they had better reason to be humble than they knew. Beginning with Copernicus in the middle 16th century, the issue was formally joined. The picture of the sun rather than the earth at the center of the universe was understood to be dangerous. Obligingly, many scholars were quick to assure the religious hierarchy that this newfangled hypothesis represented no serious challenge to conventional wisdom. In a kind of split-brain compromise, the sun-centered system was treated as a mere computational convenience, not an astronomical reality. That is, the Earth was really at the center of the universe, as everybody knew. But if you wished to predict where Jupiter would be on the second Tuesday of November the year after next, you were permitted to pretend that the sun was at the center. Then you could calculate away and not affront the authorities. "This has no danger in it," wrote Robert Cardinal Bellarmine, the foremost Vatican theologian in the early 17th century. "And suffices," he continued, "for the mathematicians. But to affirm that the sun is really fixed at the center of the heavens, and that the earth revolves very swiftly around the sun, is a dangerous thing," Cardinal Bellarmine went on, "not only irritating the theologians and philosophers, but injuring our holy faith and making the sacred scripture false." "Freedom of belief is pernicious," Bellarmine wrote on another occasion. "It is nothing but the freedom to be wrong." Besides, if the earth was going around the sun, nearby stars should seem to move against the background of more distant stars, as every 6 months we shift our perspective from one side of the earth's orbit to the other. No such annual parallax had been found. The Copernicans argued that this was because the stars were extremely far away, maybe a million times more distant than the earth is from the sun. Perhaps better telescopes in future times would find an annual parallax. The geocentrists considered this a desperate attempt to save a flawed hypothesis, and ludicrous on the face of it. When Galileo turned the first astronomical telescope to the sky, the tide began to turn. He discovered that Jupiter had a little retinue of moons circling it, the inner ones orbiting faster than the outer ones, just as Copernicus had deduced for the motion of the planets around the sun. He found that Mercury and Venus went through phases like the moon, showing they orbited the sun. Moreover, the cratered moon and the spotted sun challenged the perfection of the heavens. This may in part constitute the sort of trouble Tertullian was worried about 1,300 years earlier, when he pleaded, quote, "If you have any sense or modesty, have done with prying into the regions of the sky, into the destiny and secrets of the universe," close quote. In contrast, Galileo taught that we can interrogate nature by observation and experiments. Then, quote, "Facts which at first sight seem improbable will, even on scant explanation, drop the cloak which had hidden them and stand forth in naked and simple beauty," close quote. Are not these facts, available even for skeptics to confirm, a surer insight into God's universe than all the speculation of the theologians? But what if these facts contradict the beliefs of those who hold their religion incapable of making mistakes? The princes of the church threatened the aged astronomer with torture if he persisted in teaching the abominable doctrine that the earth moved. He was sentenced to a kind of house arrest for the remainder of his life. A generation or two later, by the time Isaac Newton demonstrated that simple and elegant physics could quantitatively explain and predict all the observed lunar and planetary motions, provided you assume the sun at the center of the solar system, the geocentrist conceit eroded further. In 1725, in an attempt to discover stellar parallax, the painstaking English amateur astronomer James Bradley stumbled on the aberration of light. The term aberration, I suppose, conveys something of the unexpectedness of the discovery. When observed over the course of a year, stars were found to trace little ellipses against the sky. But all the stars were found to do so. This could not be stellar parallax, where we would expect a big parallax for nearby stars and an indetectable one for faraway stars. Instead, aberration is similar to how raindrops falling directly down on a speeding auto seem to the passengers to be falling at a slant. The faster the car goes, the steeper the slant. If the Earth was stationary at the center of the universe and not speeding in its orbit around the sun, Bradley would not have found the aberration of light. It was a compelling demonstration that the Earth revolved about the sun. It convinced most astronomers and some others, but not, Bradley thought, the anti-Copernicans. But not until 1837 did direct observations of the stars prove in the clearest way that the Earth is indeed circling the sun. The long-debated annual parallax was at last discovered, not by better arguments, but by better instruments. Because explaining what it means is much more straightforward than explaining the aberration of light, its discovery was very important. It pounded the final nail into the coffin of geocentrism. You need only look at your finger with your left eye, and then with your right, and see it seem to move. Everybody can understand parallax. By the 19th century, all scientific geocentrists had been converted or rendered extinct. Once most scientists had been convinced, informed public opinion had swiftly changed, in some countries in a mere 3 or 4 generations. Of course, in the time of Galileo and Newton, and even much later, there were still some who objected, who tried to prevent the new sun-centered universe from becoming accepted, or even known. And there were many who at least harbored secret reservations. By the late 20th century, just in case there were any holdouts, we've been able to settle the matter directly. We've been able to test whether we live in an Earth-centered system with planets affixed to transparent crystal spheres, or in a sun-centered system with planets controlled at a distance by the gravity of the sun. We have, for example, probed the planets with radar. When we bounce a signal off a moon of Saturn, we receive no radio echo from a nearer crystal sphere attached to Jupiter. Our spacecraft arrive at their appointed destinations with astonishing precision, exactly as predicted by Newtonian gravitation. When our ships fly to Mars, say, their instruments do not hear a tinkling sound or detect shards of broken crystal as they crash through the spheres. That, according to the authoritative opinions that prevailed for millennia, propel Venus or the Sun in their dutiful motions about the central Earth. When Voyager 2 scanned the solar system from beyond the outermost planet, it saw, just as Copernicus and Galileo had said we would, the Sun in the middle and the planets in concentric orbits about it. Far from being the center of the universe, the Earth is just one of the orbiting dots. No longer confined to a single world, we are now able to reach out to others and determine decisively what kind of planetary system we inhabit. Every other proposal, and their number is legion, to displace us from cosmic center stage has also been resisted, in part for similar reasons. We seem to crave privilege, merited not by our works, but by our birth. By the mere fact that, say, we're humans and born on Earth. We might call it the anthropocentric, the human-centered conceit. This conceit is brought close to culmination in the notion that we are created in God's image. The creator and ruler of the entire universe looks just like me. My, what a coincidence. How convenient and satisfying. The 6th century BC Greek philosopher Xenophanes understood the arrogance of this perspective. Here's what he said. The Ethiopians make their gods black and snub-nosed. The Thracians say theirs have blue eyes and red hair. Yes, and if oxen and horses or lions had hands and could paint with their hands and produce works of art as men do, horses would paint the forms of the gods like horses and oxen like oxen. Such attitudes were once described as provincial. the naive expectation that the political hierarchies and social conventions of an obscure province extend to a vast empire composed of many different traditions and cultures, that the familiar boondocks, our boondocks, are the center of the world. The country bumpkins know almost nothing about what else is possible. They fail to grasp the insignificance of their province or the diversity of the empire. With ease, they apply their own standards and customs to the rest of the planet. But plop down in Vienna, say, or Hamburg or New York, ruefully they recognize how limited their perspective has been. They become deprovincialized. Modern science has been a voyage into the unknown, with a lesson in humility waiting at every stop. Many passengers would rather have stayed home. Chapter 3. The Great Demotions. One philosopher asserted that he knew the whole secret. He surveyed the two celestial strangers from top to toe and maintained to their faces that their persons, their worlds, their suns and their stars were created solely for the use of man. At this assertion, our two travelers let themselves fall against each other, seized with a fit of inextinguishable laughter. That's from Voltaire's Micromegas in 1752. In the 17th century, there was still some hope that even if the Earth was not the center of the universe, it might be the only world. But Galileo's telescope revealed that, quote, the moon certainly does not possess a smooth and polished surface, close quote, and that other worlds might look just like the face of the Earth itself. The moon and the planets showed unmistakably that they had as much claim to being worlds as the Earth does, with mountains, craters, atmospheres, polar ice caps, clouds, and, in the case of Saturn, a dazzling, unheard-of set of circumferential rings. After millennia of philosophical debate, the issue was settled decisively in favor of what was called the plurality of worlds. They might be profoundly different from our planet. None of them might be as congenial for life, but the Earth was hardly the only one. This was the next in the series of great demotions, downlifting experiences, demonstrations of our apparent insignificance, wounds that science has, in its search for Galileo's facts, delivered to human pride. Well, some hoped, even if the Earth isn't at the center of the universe, the sun is. The sun is our sun. So the Earth is approximately at the center of the universe. Perhaps some of our pride could in this way be salvaged. But by the 19th century, observational astronomy had made it clear that the sun is but one lonely star in a great self-gravitating assemblage of suns called the Milky Way galaxy. Far from being at the center of the galaxy, our sun, with its entourage of dim and tiny planets, lies in an undistinguished sector of an obscure spiral arm. We are 30,000 light years from the center. Well, our Milky Way is the only galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is in fact one of billions, perhaps hundreds of billions, of galaxies notable neither in mass, nor in brightness, nor in how its stars are configured and arrayed. Some modern deep sky photographs show more galaxies beyond the Milky Way than stars within the Milky Way. Every one of them is an island universe containing perhaps 100 billion suns. Such an image is a profound sermon on humility. Well then, at least our galaxy is at the center of the universe. Nope, this is wrong too. When the expansion of the universe was first discovered, many people naturally gravitated to the notion that the Milky Way was at the center of the expansion, and all the other galaxies running away from us. We now recognize that astronomers on any galaxy would see all the others running away from them. Unless they were very careful, they would all conclude that they were at the center of the universe. There is, in fact, no center to the expansion, no point of origin of the Big Bang, at least not in ordinary three-dimensional space. Well, even if there are hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars, no other star has planets. If there are no other planets beyond our solar system, perhaps there's no other life in the universe. Our uniqueness might then be saved. Since planets are small and feebly shine by reflected sunlight, they're hard to find. Although applicable technology is improving with breathtaking speed, even a giant world like Jupiter, orbiting the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, would still be difficult to detect. In our ignorance, the geocentrists find hope. There was once a scientific hypothesis, not just well-received but prevailing, that supposed our solar system to have formed through the near collision of the ancient sun with another star. The gravitational tidal interaction pulled out tendrils of sun stuff that quickly condensed into planets. Since space is mostly empty, and near stellar collisions most rare, it was concluded that few other planetary systems exist. Perhaps only one, around that other star that long ago co-parented the worlds of our solar system. Early in my studies, I was amazed and disappointed that such a view had ever been taken seriously, that for planets of other stars, absence of evidence had been considered evidence of absence. Today, we have firm evidence for at least three planets orbiting an extremely dense star, the pulsar designated B1257+12, and we found for more than half the stars with masses like the sun's that early in their careers, they're surrounded by great disks of gas and dust out of which planets seem to form. Other planetary systems now look to be a cosmic commonplace, maybe even world something like the Earth. We should be able in the next few decades to inventory at least the largest planets, if they exist, of hundreds of nearby stars. Well, if our position in space doesn't reveal our special role, our position in time does. We've been in the universe since the beginning, give or take a few days. We've been given special responsibilities by the Creator. It once seemed very reasonable to think of the universe as beginning just a little before our collective memory is obscured by the passage of time, and also the illiteracy of our ancestors. Generally speaking, that's hundreds or maybe thousands of years ago. Religions that purport to describe the origin of the universe often specify, implicitly or explicitly, a date of origin of roughly such vintage, a birthday for the world. If you add up all the begats in the book of Genesis, for example, you get an age for the earth, 6,000 years old, plus or minus a little. The universe is said to be exactly as old as the earth. This is still the standard of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim fundamentalists, and is clearly reflected in the Jewish calendar. But so young a universe raises an awkward question. How is it that there are astronomical objects more than 6,000 light years away? It takes light a year to travel a light year, 10,000 years to travel 10,000 light years, and so on. When we look at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, the light we see left its source some 30,000 years ago. The nearest spiral galaxy like our own, M31 in the constellation Andromeda, is 2 million light years away. So we're seeing it as it was when the light from it set out on its long journey to Earth 2 million years ago. And when we observe distant quasars 5 billion light years away, we're seeing them as they were 5 billion years ago before the Earth was formed. They are almost certainly very different today. So if, despite this, we were to accept the literal truth of such religious books, how could we reconcile the data? The only plausible conclusion, I think, is that God recently made all the photons of light arriving on the Earth in such a coherent format as to mislead generations of astronomers into the misapprehension that there are such things as galaxies and quasars, and intentionally driving them to the spurious conclusion that the universe is vast and old. This is such a malevolent theology, I still have difficulty believing that anyone, no matter how devoted to the divine inspiration of any religious book, could seriously entertain it. Beyond this, the radioactive dating of rocks, the abundance of impact craters on many worlds, the evolution of the stars, and the expansion of the universe, each provides compelling and independent evidence that our universe is many billions of years old. Despite the confident assertions of revered theologians that a world so old directly contradicts the word of God, and that at any rate information on the antiquity of the world is inaccessible except to faith. These lines of evidence as well would have to be manufactured by a deceptive and malicious deity, unless the world is much older than the literalists in the Judeo-Christian Islamic religion suppose. Of course, no such problem arises for those many religious people who treat the Bible and the Quran as historical and moral guides and great literature, but who recognize that the perspective of these scriptures on the natural world reflects the rudimentary science of the time in which they were written. Ages rolled by before the earth began. More ages will run their course before it is destroyed. A distinction needs to be drawn between how old the earth is, around 4.5 billion years, and how old the universe is, about 15 billion years since the Big Bang. The immense interval of time between the origin of the universe and our epoch was two-thirds over before the Earth came to be. Some stars and planetary systems are billions of years younger, others billions of years older. But in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, the universe and the Earth are created on the same day. The Hindu-Buddhist Jain religion tends not to confound the two events. As for humans, we're latecomers. We appear in the last instant of cosmic time. The history of the universe till now was 99.998% over before our species arrived on the scene. In that vast sweep of eons, we could not have assumed any special responsibilities for our planet or life or anything else. We were not here. Well, if we can't find anything special about our position or our epoch, maybe there's something special about our motion. Newton and all the great classical physicists held that the velocity of the Earth in space constituted a privileged frame of reference. That's actually what it was called. Albert Einstein, a key critic of prejudice and privilege all his life, considered this absolute physics a remnant of an increasingly discredited Earth chauvinism. It seemed to him that the laws of nature must be the same no matter what the velocity or frame of reference of the observer. With this as his starting point, he developed the special theory of relativity. Its consequences are bizarre, counterintuitive, they grossly contradict common sense, but only at very high speeds. Careful and repeated observations show that his justly celebrated theory is an accurate description of how the world is made. Our common sense intuitions can be mistaken. Our preferences don't count. We do not live in a privileged reference frame. One consequence of special relativity is time dilation, the slowing down of time as the observer approaches light speed. You can still find claims that time dilation applies to watches and elementary particles, and presumably to circadian and other rhythms in plants, animals, and microbes, but not to human biological clocks. Our species has been granted, it is suggested, special immunity from the laws of nature, which must accordingly be able to distinguish deserving from undeserving collections of matter. In fact, the proof Einstein gave for special relativity admits no such distinctions. The idea of humans as exceptions to relativity seems just another incarnation of the notion of special creation. Special creation. Well, even if our position, our epoch, our motion, and our world are not unique, maybe we are. We're different from the other animals. We're specially created. The particular devotion of the creator of the universe is evident in us. This position was passionately defended on religious and other grounds. But in the middle 19th century, Charles Darwin showed convincingly how one species can evolve into another by entirely natural processes, which come down to the heartless business of nature saving the heredities that work and rejecting those that don't. Man, in his arrogance, thinks himself a great work, worthy of the interposition of a deity. Darwin wrote telegraphically in his notebook, more humble, and I think truer, to consider him created from animals. Close quote. The profound and intimate connections of humans with the other life forms on Earth has been compellingly demonstrated in the late 20th century by the new science of molecular biology. In each age, the self-congratulatory chauvinisms are challenged in yet another arena of scientific debate. In this century, for example, in attempts to understand the nature of human sexuality, the existence of the unconscious mind, and the fact that many psychiatric illnesses and character defects have a molecular origin. But also, well, even if we're closely related to some of the other animals, we're different, not just in degree, but in kind, on what really matters: reasoning, self-consciousness, tool-making, ethics, altruism, religion, language, nobility of character. While humans, like all animals, have traits that set them apart, otherwise how could we distinguish one species from another? Human uniqueness has been exaggerated, sometimes grossly so. Chimps reason, are self-conscious, make tools, show devotion, and so on. Chimps and humans have 99.6% of their active genes in common. Andrian and I run through the evidence in our book Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. In popular culture, the very opposite position is also embraced, although it too is driven by human chauvinism, plus a failure of the imagination. Children's stories and cartoons make animals dress in clothes, live in houses, use knives and forks, and speak. The three bears sleep in beds. The owl and the pussycat go to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. Dinosaur mothers cuddle their young. Pelicans deliver the mail. Dogs drive cars. A worm catches a thief. Pets have human names. Dolls, nutcrackers, cups and saucers dance and have opinions. The dish runs away with the spoon. In the Thomas the Tank Engine series, we even have anthropomorphic locomotives and railway cars charmingly portrayed. No matter what we're thinking about, animate or inanimate, we tend to invest it with human traits. We can't help ourselves. The images come readily to mind. Children are clearly fond of them. When we talk about a threatening sky, a troubled sea, diamonds resisting being scratched, the Earth attracting a passing asteroid, or an atom being excited, we are again drawn to a kind of animist worldview. We reify. Some ancient level of our thinking endows inanimate nature with life, passions, and forethought. The notion that the Earth is self-aware has lately been growing at the fringes of the Gaia hypothesis. But this was a commonplace belief of both the ancient Greeks and the early Christians. Origen wondered whether, quote, the earth also, according to its own nature, is accountable for some sin, close quote. A host of ancient scholars thought the stars alive. This was also the position of Origen, of St. Ambrose, the mentor of St. Augustine, and even in a more qualified form of St. Thomas Aquinas. The Stoic philosophical position on the sun's nature was stated by Cicero in the 1st century B.C., quote, since the sun resembles those fires which are contained in the bodies of living creatures, the sun must also be alive, close quote. Animist attitudes in general seem to have been spreading recently. In a 1954 American survey, 75% of people polled were willing to state that the sun is not alive. In 1989, though, only 30% would support so rash a proposition. On whether an automobile tire can feel anything, 90% of respondents denied it emotions in 1954, but only 73% in 1989. We can recognize here a shortcoming, in some circumstances serious, in our ability to understand the world. Characteristically, willy-nilly, we seem compelled to project our own nature onto nature. Although this may result in a consistently distorted view of the world, It does have one great virtue. Projection is the essential precondition for compassion. Okay, maybe we're not much. Maybe we're humiliatingly related to apes. But at least we're the best there is. God and angels aside, we're the only intelligent beings in the universe. One correspondent writes to me, quote, "I am as sure of this as anything in my experience. There is no conscious life anywhere else in the universe. Mankind thus returns to its rightful position as center of the universe," close quote. However, partly through the influence of science and science fiction, most people today, in the United States at least, reject this proposition for reasons I think essentially stated by the ancient Greek philosopher Chrysippus, who said, "For any human being in existence to think that there is nothing in the whole world superior to himself would be an insane piece of arrogance." Close quote. But the simple fact is that we have not yet found extraterrestrial life. We're in the earliest stages of looking. The question is wide open. If I had to guess, especially considering our long sequence of failed chauvinisms, I'd guess that the universe is filled with beings far more intelligent, far more advanced than we are. But of course, I might be wrong. Such a conclusion is at best based on a plausibility argument, derived from the numbers of planets, the ubiquity of organic matter, the immense timescales available for evolution, and so on. It's not a scientific demonstration. The question is among the most fascinating in all of science. We are just developing the tools to treat it seriously. What about the related matter of whether we are capable of creating intelligences smarter than ourselves? Computers routinely do mathematics that no unaided human can manage, outperform world champions in checkers and grandmasters in chess, speak and understand English and other languages, write presentable short stories and musical compositions, learn from their mistakes, and competently pilot ships, airplanes, and spacecraft. Their abilities steadily improve. They're getting smaller, faster, and cheaper. Every year, the tide of scientific advance laps a little further ashore on the island of human intellectual uniqueness with its embattled castaways. If, at so early a stage in our technological evolution, we have been able to go so far in creating intelligence of silicon and metal, what will be possible in the following decades and centuries? What happens when smart machines are able to manufacture smarter machines? Perhaps the clearest indication that the search for an unmerited privileged position for humans will never be wholly abandoned is what in physics and astronomy is called the anthropic principle. It would be better named the anthropocentric principle. It comes in various forms. The weak anthropic principle merely notes that if the laws of nature and the physical constants, such as the speed of light, the electrical charge of the electron, the national constant, or these had been different, the course of events leading to the origin of humans would never have transpired. Under other laws and constants, atoms would not hold together, or stars would evolve too quickly to leave sufficient time for life to evolve on nearby planets, or the chemical elements of which life is made would never have been generated, and so on. Different laws, no humans. There is no controversy about the weak anthropic principle. Change the laws and constants of nature, if you could, and a very different universe may emerge, in many cases a universe incompatible with life. The mere fact that we exist implies, but does not impose, constraints on the laws of nature. By contrast, the various strong anthropic principles go much further. Some of their advocates come close to deducing that the laws of nature and the values of the physical constants were established, don't ask how or by whom, so that humans would eventually come to be. Almost all of the other possible universes, they say, are inhospitable. In this way, the ancient conceit that the universe was made for us is resuscitated. To me, it echoes Dr. Pangloss in Voltaire's Candide, convinced that this world, with all its imperfections, is the best possible. It sounds like playing my first hand of bridge, winning, knowing that there are 54 billion, 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 that is 5.4 times 10 to the 28th, possible other hands that I was equally likely to have been dealt, and then foolishly concluding that a god of bridge exists who favors me, a god who arranged the cards in the shuffle with my victory foreordained from the beginning. We do not know how many other winning hands there are in the cosmic deck, how many other kinds of universes, laws of nature, and physical constants that could also lead to life and intelligence, and perhaps even delusions of self-importance. Since we know next to nothing about how the universe was made, or even if it was made, it's difficult to pursue these matters productively. Voltaire asked, "Why is there anything?" Einstein's formulation was to ask whether God had any choice in creating the universe. But if the universe is infinitely old, if the Big Bang some 15 billion years ago is only the most recent cusp in an infinite series of cosmic contractions and expansions, then it was never created, and the question of why it is rendered meaningless. If, on the other hand, the universe is a finite age, why is it the way it is? Why wasn't it given a very different character? Which laws of nature go with which others? Are there meta-laws specifying the connections? Can we possibly discover them? Of all conceivable laws of gravity, say, which ones can exist simultaneously with which conceivable laws of quantum physics that determine the very existence of macroscopic matter? Are all laws we can think of possible? Or is there only a restricted number that can somehow be brought into existence? Clearly, we have not a glimmering of how to determine which laws of nature are possible and which are not, nor do we have more than the most rudimentary notion of what correlation of natural laws are permitted. For example, Newton's universal law of gravitation specifies that the mutual gravitational force attracting two bodies towards each other is inversely proportional to the square of how far they are apart,